The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Australia has been put into a deep freeze, as people have said. It was difficult for Australian ministers to get meetings with Chinese counterparts. China has already lost Australia. It basically doesn't really make any effort in improving the relationship anymore. So maybe perhaps what it is doing is using Australia as an example for other countries.
It didn't start with Australia. We've seen it with Korea. We've seen it with Japan on rare earths. We've seen it with the Philippines on bananas. But the Australia moves are just, they seem to be escalating. No end seems to be in sight. And frankly, you know, I don't think it's going to end with Australia if there is not an international response, because what does China conclude then? Basically, they have the market power to do this, and it's cost-free. So the message to other countries is, don't criticize us, because we'll hit your products next.
I'm Jordan Schneider, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 14th, 2020. At the start of the show, I sit down with Yun Jiang, former Australian government official and an editor at the Australian National University's China Story blog. In late November, we did a deep dive into the Australia-China relationship, providing much-needed context on why tension has boiled over in recent months. After recording this podcast, Yun and I authored a piece fleshing out moves the U.S. could take to shore up Australia. These include a strategic Shiraz reserve and a mutual trade defense pact. For more detail, check out my newsletter at chinatalk.substack.com. In the final half of this edition of Lawfare, I air an interview I recorded this past Friday with Wendy Cutler, longtime USTR official currently at the Asia Society. We talk about how Biden could address China on trade and hear her takes on our policy proposals. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 14th, China-Australia relations and what the U.S. should do about it. Yun Jiang, welcome to China Talk.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's get into it.
Well, Australia and China has a long history of engagement, but just like a bit like the United States, Australia had a white Australia policy until I think was the 80s. But before that, there was a lot of Chinese migrants to Australia with the gold rush. I think it's a similar story in the United States as well. But then there was a white Australia policy right from the Federation. So one of the first acts actually passed when Australia became one country was to exclude Asian migration. So Immigration Restrictions Act. I think, again, it's very similar to the United States.
What year was this?
1901.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that white Australia policy continued until it was only dismantled in the 70s or 80s. And then when the immigration policy of Australia started to focus on skilled migration, that's actually when there was start to have a lot of immigrants coming from China, as well as from Southeast Asia, with people from Chinese heritage from Southeast Asia as well. So the Chinese Australian communities in Australia is very diverse. You have more recent students and migrants from mainland China, but you also have people from Hong Kong, from Taiwan, and people from Southeast Asia, and people that have stayed in Australia for many generations, or you have recent migrants. So it's a very diverse community. So that's the community aspect. But then there's a political aspect. The relationship, I think next year, 2021, I think, is the 50th anniversary of the establishment of relationship between the People's Republic of China and Australia. So it's a big anniversary, but then right now we have this all these tensions at the time. So I'm not sure how that will be commemorated. So the relationship between China and Australia in recent decades has mostly been focused on economic aspects. So China is Australia's biggest trading partner and has been for many years. We import.
China imports $90 billion of Australian exports, which comprises 33% of total Australian exports. And next up is Japan, only has 9%. So a pretty big drop off. In the U.S., poor little America, only at $10 billion with 3.7%.
But hey, America enjoys a trade surplus with Australia, so you should really be thankful to us.
Okay, so a big, big important trading partner and has been for a long time now.
Yeah, for quite a while now, both imports and exports. Sure. And that is the one aspect of relationship that is very important to Australian politicians.
Let's take it to 2014 then. Now that we got all that history out of the way.
Okay. So 2014 was a high point of the bilateral relationship. Australia was hosting the G20 and Xi Jinping came to Australia and actually addressed the special joint sitting of the parliament. So upper house as the senators and the lower house is the members of representatives. So you have those people all sitting, listening to Xi Jinping, addressing them in the parliament. From the standpoint from now, it seems to be, you can't believe that, but that's what happened in 2014. Xi Jinping has actually visited all the states and territories of Australia. Not as many as the United States, but it's still an impressive record. We signed the free trade agreement, the CHAPTA, and also the bilateral relationship was upgraded to comprehensive strategic partnership, which is basically the highest you can get apart from a formal alliance. So that was a high point of the relationship. The prime minister and all the politicians were quite positive about the bilateral relationship. I think the only party that was a little bit wary was the Greens. I think it was because of human rights. But basically, everyone was very positive about the relationship. Liberal was in power. There's mostly two parties, a coalition, which is the Liberal National Party and the Labour. So at that time, it was the coalition that was in power, just like now.
Okay. Which is right of center.
Yes, of center. And it is a current ruling government in Australia as well. It's the same party.
Okay. Okay. So what happened starting in 2017?
2017 and 2018. That is a turning point for the relationship. So in late 2017, Australia introduced the foreign interference legislation. Now, the foreign interference legislation itself is country neutral. It doesn't mention any country. But when it was introduced and the debate and rhetoric around its introduction was very much focused on China. Malcolm Turnbull, the prime minister at the time, which is also Liberal National Party, even spoke in Mandarin saying basically that Australian people have stood up, which is echoing what Mao Zedong supposedly to have said. And I think that is perceived as quite a slight to the People's Republic of China.
You quote Xi to Xi's face, he's not going to be super happy about it, even if you're the likes of Ma Yun. So yeah, not the slyest rhetorical tactic, to be sure. What was the motivation at the time around passing this bill in the first place?
The motivation around time, which is that there's increased concerns about China's foreign interference activities in Australia. Specifically, around at that time, there was a lot of concerns about bribery of politicians, influencing of politicians. There was a case of Huang Xiaomo and Sam Diastari, basically accepting bribes and then also speaking on issues that's contrary to the party position. So there was a lot of concerns around that. And then Clive Hamilton's book on silent, called Silent Invasion, was also built around that kind of issue as well. Okay, and then in early 2018, there was the Huawei decision that was also quite important. So Huawei was actually blocked from Australia's national broadband network in 2012. But at that time, it didn't create much of a diplomatic incidence. But in 2018, when Huawei was blocked from the 5G network, it did create a lot of tension between the two countries. I think there were two reasons. One is that Australia was quite public about the ban, and that the fact that the risks was about China as a country, basically. And the second one is that Australia then was quite forward-leaning about trying to get other countries to also ban Huawei. So those two decisions, I think, was basically the turning point in the relationship. And since then, I remember from then on, basically, Australia has been put into a deep freeze, as people have said. It was difficult for Australian ministers to get meetings with Chinese counterparts. And then it came 2020.
One question before we come up to the present day. To what extent is this driven by internal Australian dynamics versus the impact of Trump and the trade war and sort of the U.S. kind of pushing its allies to rethink their relationships with China?
You're asking a very good question, and I think that might need a very full response. In part, the China-Australian relationship is driven by the U.S.-China relationship as well. Australia is an ally of the United States. We have, as former Prime Minister said, 100 years of mateship. We have followed the United States in pretty much every conflict, every major conflict. The alliance with the United States is very important to Australia. And in one sense, the Australian government, especially the Liberal National Coalition government, which is probably sees the alliance as more important than maybe the Labour government, wants to be seen as quite close to the United States. And the tension between the United States and China doesn't help the bilateral relationship between Australia and China either. But in a sense, Australia is even more forward-leaning than the United States. We can see that with the Huawei decision, which Australia, I think, made that decision even before the United States did. That is one part of the tension. And then another one, I'm sure you will know, that there is the intersection of domestic politics and foreign policy as well, which if you live in a country, you're probably more aware. This also happens in China, but because we are outside the country, we see China as one monolith. We don't tend to think about its internal machinations. But from Australia's standpoint, they're in the Liberal National Government, particularly in this one, the Minister for Home Affairs has much more power. In fact, the portfolio was created so that it did gather more power. So in that sense, the national security concerns have become more dominant in domestic politics as well, as opposed to, say, for example, economic concerns. And that you can see that played into domestic discourse in the public. Foreign interference, for example, was not really talked about until recent years. But now it seems that national security concerns has taken more dominant in the public discourse compared to, say, trade and economics.
I guess coming back to the question I asked earlier, is this also a function of Chinese influence operations becoming more aggressive and more heavy-handed?
It's possible every country look to influence other countries. There are a difference between legitimate influence and illegitimate interference activities. And interference activities is defined in the legislation as covert, coercive, corrupting. That's right, three C's. So the influence is legitimate, and a lot of United Front work is influence work rather than interference work. But in the public debate, there seems to be a confusion between the two. And any influence now from China is seen as illegitimate. Now, interference by nature is hard to detect since the passage of the foreign interference legislation. So far, we only have one charge one person being charged under it, and that's quite recent. And there is no details about exactly what he has done either. In that sense, it's hard to tell whether China is now more active in foreign interference in Australia. It is quite possible it is. China has become more powerful. It seems to be more interested in getting other countries to be aligned to its interests. So I think it is, from that standpoint, it's possible that foreign interference activities have increased, but then we don't have any evidence, at least in public yet.
So coming to 2020, I guess we should start with COVID.
Yeah, let's start with COVID. There are a few issues in 2020. The Australian government's push to have an independent investigation into the origin of COVID seems to be a quite significant one in the bilateral relationship.
So what was going on there? Why did this become such a something that the Australians were so focused on doing?
It is a little bit a mystery, because apparently not all the, I think from recent Senate inquiries, it appears that not every department or not all bureaucracies understand what's happening. It does not seem to be a well-formed policy view. Like, it's not something that has, you know, considered by different departments, gone through a cabinet, everyone agrees. It did some, did seem to have come out of nowhere. And also the fact that other countries did not seem to have really been on board either. It is a bit strange. So it's very strange, where did it come from? Now, before all that, there was a lot of media speculations as well about origin of COVID, including there was a document handed over to the media by the United States Embassy casting doubts about the origin of COVID. So all these things, it seems to be very strange, all the surrounding circumstances. And then Australia came out and wanted an independent investigation of COVID. Now, the investigation itself is fine. Other countries have pushed for it too, including the European Union. They had proposed a WHO proposal. But what Australia seemed to have proposed is went far beyond that. It wanted more power for WHO, almost like a weapons inspections power is one that was raised. Mm-hmm. So Australia have gone beyond what other countries have asked for. And it seems to be very targeted at China. So from China's perspective, it was not happy about what Australia. Then what? And then the ambassador had an interview with one of the newspapers here. He warned Australia that the tensions in the relationship will not be good for trade. It can be seen as a warning or a threat. Basically, he named a few things like wine, tourism, and things that actually eventuate that the Chinese government did take actions against Australia.
So how did the Australian politicians take to this interview?
The Australian politicians, obviously, you can't be seen as backing down in the face of coercion. So they were very, like now, all politicians are very, what's the word?
I think Kevin Rudd said hairy chested, right?
Oh my God. Hairy chested. I don't even know what that means. I am not very good with analogies and imageries personally, but I haven't even gone to the issue of Wolverines yet, but we'll get to that later.
Of course, of the summer, also another sort of big event was China grabbing Australian journal.
So that one's very interesting. Okay, so first thing that happened is that Australian journalist who works for CGTN, the Chinese state broadcaster, Chen Lei, got detained for, and later emerged, was for national security reasons, and we still don't know.
And this is mid-August we're in now.
Mm. So we don't really know what happened there. And then, I think only maybe a week or so later, there was two Australian journalists working for Australian newspapers that was hurried into the Australian embassy. What happened was they received a knock from the Chinese government. Basically, they want to question them about certain issues. And they feel this seems to be quite serious. And I think on the back of the Australian embassy's advice, they received protection at the embassy. So they were actually subsequently interviewed by the Chinese government at the embassy, and they were allowed to leave. But initially, they were threatened that unless you comply with us, you are not allowed to leave. And obviously, at that time, that would be quite scary. So then they were allowed to leave.
Yeah. And this, I imagine, caused a stir domestically.
Yes, very much, of course. But quite interestingly, a few weeks later, it then emerged that when the Australian Federal Police and the Security Intelligence Organization raided one of the Australian politicians called Musselman, I think, in connection with a possible foreign interference investigation, they also raided two Chinese journalists in Australia, but it wasn't publicized at the time. And apparently they, you know, took away their phones and laptops and also told them to keep quiet. And then those two Chinese journalists left Australia. It was definitely before the two Australian media journalists. Yeah. So it was actually, it appears that the questioning and I guess threat to the two Australian journalists was possibly a retaliation for what Australian government did to the Chinese journalists.
God. So starting September 1st, we have a headline, China bans barley imports. Harmful weeds were in the cargo. You have a kickoff of what's now, I guess, a sort of one-way trade war.
So barley was the first, and then came beef, and then all the others followed. At first, it wasn't really certain what's going on. There was a lot of speculation whether this was a form of economic coercion or was it a more of a pure economic coercion in terms of like they are using economic instruments for geopolitical ends, for geopolitical purpose, or whether it was a purely economics. For example, they were unhappy with Australia's anti-dumping actions. So that will be purely economics. But then I think it was quite obvious after a while that it was economic statecraft, that China basically is using economics, using trade to send a political message to Australia. It's quite strange what China is trying to achieve, though. When you do something like that, obviously you have an end goal in mind, hopefully, supposedly. I mean, there's a few theories. One is that it's targeted Australia. Two is that it's targeted other countries, not Australia. And three is targeted domestic audiences.
Yeah.
So there could be a lot of motivations for doing such things.
So Yun, what was your experience giving testimony to Parliament?
Okay, so I put in a recent submission to a Senate inquiry into issues facing diaspora communities. And my submission dealt with issues facing diaspora communities. Specifically, one is on coercion from the Chinese government. So where individuals in Australia, their families may be pressured from the Chinese government in order for them to stay silent. And the second one was the increased suspicion on Chinese Australians in Australia due to the foreign interference debate. So we're seeing in the media and in a lot of public debate that people are basically saying certain people, because of their connection, perhaps because they have met a Unite Front official or because they belong to a community group that is perhaps what seemed to be a Unite Front aligned group, that then their loyalties are being questioned, that they are being under suspicion of foreign interference. My submission mostly dealt with that, and I got invited by the Senate committee to appear in the inquiry. Now, usually when you appear in the Senate inquiry, you go one by one, but interestingly, this time they asked me to appear along with two other witnesses, supposedly because of time constraints. So it was by teleconferencing. So all three of us showed up by teleconferencing to the Senate inquiry, and I made my opening statement, which was again focused on foreign interference and suspicions on Chinese Australians and the fact that we should not ask Chinese Australians to, for example, take a political stance when we don't ask other Australians to do so. One of the senators, Senator Eric Abetz, Liberal National from Tasmania, an island in the south of Australia, very beautiful. And incidentally, Xi Jinping visited Tasmania in 2014, and Senator Abetz was very positive about Xi Jinping's visit. Okay, so he's from the Liberal National government, Liberal National Party, which is the ruling party in Australia at the moment. But he's not a minister. He's one of the members of Inter-Parliamentary Committee on China as well. So he asked each of us to publicly condemn the Chinese Communist Party dictatorship. That's in his words. So then each of us gave a response. So all three of us are Australians of Chinese background. So one of us was born in Australia, one was born in Hong Kong, and I was born in mainland. And we all had different background as well. So our submissions dealt with three separate issues as well. We didn't talk about the same thing either. So it was quite strange to put us all together in one hearing to begin with. And then we were asked to publicly condemn the Chinese dictatorship. Then I realized later on that he didn't ask that from anyone else. I was obviously very shocked. This inquiry was not on Chinese Communist Party at all, or China. It has nothing to do. One of the submissions had nothing to do on China. It did not mention China or Chinese. It was inquiring on issues facing diaspora communities. Mm-hmm. So I was very shocked to be asked that question because I thought it was quite irrelevant to the inquiry. And also seems to be very strange to ask where none of us were really public office holders. I'm a person, I'm no longer in government. So it's very strange to be asked that question. It was very shocked. So I gave a response. But then I also said, as I said in my opening statement, you should not be asking Chinese Australians to take a political view when you don't ask the same from other Australians.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's literally coming exactly what you were trying to not get at. And it was the perfect example of upsetting trend in domestic politics.
Exactly. I just feel like, well, did I just waste my 5 minutes talking about this exact issue and you just come out and then do exactly what I said you should not do? And then I feel, look, what the hell am I doing here? It's quite clear that they're not interested in my views on foreign interference. They didn't ask any question about foreign interference. The only thing they seem to be interested in is my view of the Chinese Communist Party. It's quite upsetting that it just feels like I was called there purely so that they can make a political domestic point.
Was there, you know, in the US we had McCarthyism and blacklists and this kind of like communist fear, which wasn't quite as ethnic. I mean, it was a little bit of sort of like the Jews are communists, but it wasn't like we have a fifth column. I mean, I guess it was in the 30s with the Germans and then with the Japanese. So I take this back. But I'm curious if in Australia there is sort of a history of this strain of thinking, or whether this is a new thing. And in the Cold War, there wasn't this sort of undercurrent in Australian politics.
Actually, in the United States, there was, during the Cold War, if you remember, that some Chinese scientists were pushed out of the United States because of the suspicion as well. So history repeats itself. In Australia, there's racism itself, obviously, has historically been a feature of Australian society when we talk about white Australia policy. Now that we see white Australia policy is quite racist, obviously, but at the time, white Australia policy, the official government position was that white Australia policy was not a racist policy. It was purely economics. There, I think there's definitely an undercurrent of racism, and we know that structural racism exists as well.
But I guess I guess not just the racism, but like the fear of foreign influence manifesting itself in domestic politics. Is that something that's happened to this extent ever before?
So Australia also had internment camps for Japanese and Germans during Second World War as well.
So coming back to the Wolverines, who are they and what's their deal?
So War of the Ring is a group of parliamentarians. They're very willing to publicly stand up to China. I think that's how they will put it, to stand up to interference as well as other issues on China. So, for example, they've been talking about human rights atrocities committed in the PRC by the Chinese government or by the Chinese Communist Party, but also basically any issue to do with China, they are quite come out quite publicly. I think Andrew Hastie is probably one of the more well-known members. So basically, there are just a group of parliamentarians who wants to be public about countering China. I found one sense it's a bit unusual in the Australian system, because in the Australian system, you have the Westminster system. So we have the ministers, which are also parliamentarians. Yep. And then we have a cabinet minister, which are usually the ones that make the most decisions for the government. And then we have a party. So the party disciplines are usually stronger in Australia than, for example, in the United States. So usually the politicians within the party mm-hmm. do not usually, for example, come out against the party position. And the backbenchers do not usually have a very high profile as a result. So it's quite unusual to have a group that comes out so publicly on especially a foreign affair issue as well from a group of backbenchers. It's unusual in the system.
So not quite at the level of Martin Luther's 95 Theses, but the Chinese government came out with 14 complaints that they had about Australian behavior. And how do you factor it?
Yeah, I was told I was featured. Well, I mean, not by name, right?
Okay, so here we go. 14 grievances. We got foreign investment decisions. We got Huawei, foreign interference legislation, politicization and stigmatization of normal exchanges, excessive wanton interference in Xinjiang, Xiangang, and Taiwan. The first country who's not connected directly to the South China Sea to talk about the South China Sea, siding with the U.S.'s anti-China campaign to spread disinformation about COVID-19, new legislation aimed at torpedoing participation in BNR in the Belt and Road Initiative, providing funding to anti-China think tanks for spreading untrue reports, peddling lies about Xinjiang and so-called China infiltration, the early dawn source of Chinese journalists, thinly veiled allegations against China on cyber attacks, the outrageous condemnation of the governing party of China by MPs and racist attacks against Chinese or Asian people, and last but not least, an unfriendly or antagonistic report on China by media, poisoning the atmosphere of bilateral relations. So we've covered a fair amount of these in our conversation over the past 45 minutes. I'm surprised, frankly, like America hasn't started or like the super anti-China senators haven't started a like, let's all drink Australian wine campaign. I feel like that's in the offing.
You should. That's the thing, right? That's the thing. Look, we follow you. We don't really follow you, but I'm just saying that they're from perception from Australia. Let's say from Australia's perspective, we're so close to the United States. We go with the United States on many issues. And then when China punishes us, you guys don't even buy up our stuff.
I think that's totally fair.
Disappointing.
So it's interesting because there is a bit of a floor in that iron ore in particular seems to be something that China can't really do without.
For now, but I think they are going to look to, for example, so a few things they're doing to reduce reliance on Australia as well. Now, we talk about trade diversification from Australia, but really, China also does trade diversification so that it can become less reliant on Australia. A few things they do, one is that they make investment in other countries in mining so that it can secure supplies from other countries. And the second thing is they are moving to restructuring their economy so that it may be less reliant on imported energy sources, including from Australia. And that's one of their net zero target as well. Everything's connected.
Fitting. So Yun, where do we go from here? I feel like just as someone who knows nothing about Australian politics, once you have this train, it's very hard for folks in a democracy to back down.
Yeah. One thing Australia can do is to look at what other countries have done when faced with this issue. So we know that Japan, South Korea, both have been receiving the same treatment mm-hmm. from China in the past. So we can learn a few lessons from what they've done. And in terms also in terms of managing the bilateral relationship more broadly, I think Australia should do less talking and more listening when we're meeting with countries in Southeast Asia or Japan or South Korea. And really, they've been dealing with this, living next to a great power for much longer than Australia has. So I think they have a lot of experiences to share. And I think Australia should really trying to learn from them. I think at the moment, Australia is a little bit arrogant in that we like to go to these countries and say, oh, warn them about the threat of China. But really, they've been living with China for much longer than us. I think they probably know more about how to deal with it than us. So I think we should turn around and be more humble and learn from other countries. So that's one thing. And the second thing is, of course, just like the United States and other countries, I always push for multilateralism. I think we should definitely work with other countries to dealing with the challenges that is posed by China. So we're not like in the United States where it's a great power. It can afford to be unilateral. Australia is a middle power. We need to work with other countries in the region in order to ensure that what happens in the international sphere is in our interest. So that is one thing that is done at global level. At a domestic level, I think there need to be a more of an understanding of China, for one, both from national security and from economic and from all different aspects point of view. So the Australian government, the bureaucrats, really need to become more Asia literate, not just China literate, but also Asia literate. So you have a more understanding of the issues facing our region. But also, we need to have a better framework to connect national security, foreign policy, domestic policy, economics together. Right now, it's a little bit of siloed. You've got departments that working on economics, departments are working on national security, but they don't really understand issues that each the other departments are working. I think one thing, so I do want to mention is, so the public debate is very much focused on problem. But for policymakers, when we want to find solutions, just because there's a problem doesn't mean that any solution to address that problem is acceptable or ideal. Okay, my mom is a doctor, so I like to use medical analogies. Now, if you have presented with the symptoms, you first have to make a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And even when you made a diagnosis, then you have to decide on the treatment, the best course of treatment. Even though we know that there are challenges in the bilateral relationship, there are challenges with China, dealing with China, doesn't mean that any policy instrument to counter that is a good one. So I think we need to separate that fact that there's a problem to, you know, what is the best policy response? There are two different questions.
Profound and a lesson on which I think American policymakers should meditate as well. Not to mention Chinese policymakers for whom this whole, yes. you know, this whole episode seems really, really, really counterproductive.
Yeah. It is a very complex and tricky issue because a lot of issues is not just foreign policy. It's an intersection of foreign and domestic policies and politics. It is very difficult. And what we're seeing also is that governments appears to be using the threats and challenges posed by China to increase the power of national security agencies. And that may have implications for civil liberties as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's just thinking about the trend of the, like, once you use this, it ends up kind of poisoning the well for a very, very long time, right? And you know, these tariffs are going to be a part of Australian political memory for decades, likely. And the steps that you mentioned of folks trying to diversify and look more to other countries in Southeast Asia, you know, clearly she has his reasons for doing this. He's not an idiot, right? But at the same time, if you're only looking at the foreign policy sense, there's very little good that could possibly come out of this for Beijing.
Yeah, I guess from Xi's perspective, like most countries, they are more concerned about domestic politics than foreign policies. China has already lost Australia. It basically doesn't really make any effort in improving the relationship anymore. So maybe perhaps what it is doing is using Australia as an example for other countries. And it's one possible explanation, at least.
We recorded our last conversation, I guess, a week and a half ago, and a lot has happened since then. Why don't you catch us up on the latest developments?
Oh, I think since last time we spoke, China imposed anti-dumping tariffs on Australian wine exports. And then Australia decided to take China to the World Trade Organization on the anti-dumping tariffs on barley. And the most recent event, which got a lot of media attention, was a tweet of an offensive image by China's foreign ministry spokesperson, Zhao Lijian.
So what was this tweet and what response did it engender?
So the offensive image that the foreign ministry spokesperson, Zhao Lijian, tweeted was an image of an Australian soldier holding a knife to an Afghan child's throat. The image itself was created by a Chinese artist. It has obviously been digitally created or altered after fashion of like a satirical cartoons, but a bit more realistic. So there was a lot of media about, you know, the fact that whether it's a fake image or not, but the issue is not whether it's an image is real or not. We know that if Zhao Lijian had tweeted a real photo of Australian soldiers committing war crimes, as had been shown on Australian national TV previously, there would still be the same controversy. So a bit of background on this whole Afghan war crime business. The tweet came after a report found evidence of possible war crimes committed by the Australian Defence Force in Afghanistan. The report and its recommendations have become quite controversial domestically in Australia, even before Zhao's tweet. And I'm not sure if Zhao was aware of the domestic sensitivity of the issue. So basically, the Chief of Defence Force, after the report came out, said that Defence will accept all the recommendations. But then the Prime Minister came out later and said, we'll have to wait and see. So there is a public different positions between the Prime Minister and the Chief of Defence Force. So that was quite unusual and it caused a lot of controversy domestically. And then Zhao's tweet came out and the Prime Minister arranged almost a press conference immediately, basically saying how much the Australians are outraged by the tweet. But from a domestic angle, and that's something that hasn't really been explored a lot in international reporting, is that the Prime Minister haven't actually used such a strong language for the actual crimes committed by the Australian Defence Force. So domestically, it's a little bit strange for the Prime Minister to come out so strongly against Zhao's tweet when, you know, a more serious crime, possible war crimes, he didn't have the same reaction. Now, In the international angle, we know that. I guess a frequent listener of China Talk know that. Zhao Lijian, a foreign ministry spokesperson, deputy director in the foreign ministry, not very senior, you know, not a head of the government, head of state, not even a head of the ministry, but he's very famous on Twitter. He is an example of the so-called wolf warrior diplomacy tactics by China. Wolf warrior diplomacy is a term used to describe the newly assertive and combative style of Chinese diplomats. you know, until quite recently, Chinese diplomats have been known to be quite conservative and mild-mannered. But Zhao is deliberately provocative and inflammatory on Twitter, and he has a history. Last year, he got into a heat argument with Susan Rice, former U.S. National Security Advisor, and this year he shared a conspiracy theory from a non-conspiracy website that COVID was originally in the United States. And that, again, got a lot of criticisms, but again, he refused to back down. So obviously, he's not going to apologize for this specific tweet that is offensive to Australia or hurt Australian people's feelings, as if you would use the Chinese government's term. But it's quite clear, though, that his behavior received support from top officials within the Chinese government. And his antics enjoys some widespread support among nationalists online as well.
What's going on in Zhao Lijian's head?
Well, I think Zhao Lijian, well, first, China-Australian relationship has been deteriorating, well, since 2017, but especially this year, throughout this year. And China has been using a lot of tactics to pressure Australia. And Zhao's behavior just to provoke a reaction in Australia. And I guess if in that sense, he succeeded. The Australian Prime Minister held a press conference almost immediately. So that was a very strong reaction compared to, say, for example, maybe a normal course of reaction will be for the Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade to rebuke the diplomat, right? But the Prime Minister came out so strongly, perhaps out of domestic imperative as well. He provoked a reaction, and that's basically what he does. He's almost like a troll on Twitter. Twitter is banned in China, so it is exclusively focused at foreign audiences. And his intention is to provoke a reaction, to be provocative and to be insulting, and he achieved that aim.
What should the Prime Minister have done?
From my personal perspective, I think the Prime Minister, being a lot more senior than Zhao Lijian, probably shouldn't give us so much attention. It is offensive to most Australian people, I agree. But he didn't have to escalate this so much. You know, he could have ordered the Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade to make a statement, to have a press release, rather than arranging a press conference immediately after the fact. I think that basically escalated the issue, and it gave the issue much more oxygen and attention than you deserved, to be honest, because when you think about it, from Australia's national interest perspective, the offensive tweet itself, yes, it does hurt a little bit to some section of the community, but Chinese government's other actions, egregious actions, is much more detrimental to the Australian national interest. For example, its trade actions is significant for Australia's economy. So those issues are now strangely being overlooked in favor of this tweet episode.
And more broadly, Yoon, what's the best response for Western countries when kind of having to deal with this sort of whataboutism?
You're talking about how the Chinese government like to point out other countries' human rights failings. Well, I think one that, as some politicians have pointed out, we need to first acknowledge that there are failings in human rights in Western democracies, but we are doing our best to be transparent and to change our policies and behaviors to improve human rights situations in our countries. And contrast that with China, which is has been repeatedly denying that it has done anything wrong. So I think the right way to go about it is to acknowledge our failings, but to contrast that with China. I think the wrong way to go about it is to deny that we have human rights problems to begin with.
Jun, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Next up, my interview with Wendy Cutler, recorded December 11th.
Wendy, what would the world look like if the WTO just completely died.
Meaning if they stopped caring and they didn't view it or they didn't take the rules seriously, yeah. Then basically, in my view, you have the Wild West in the world with respect to trade policy. No certainty, no rules. A country could change their rules tomorrow. They could impose 100% tariffs on your goods. They could tell you your services couldn't come in. And so basically, it would be a very unpredictable and chaotic world. And so what you want are some basic rules. And frankly, the WTO is successful at that. There are basic rules of non-discrimination. Countries lock in where their tariffs will be. They agree to rules like most favored nation and national treatment, transparency. And I think all of those rules are important and should stay in place. But I would hope that those rules could be updated and expanded to address the realities of trade today. Because the problem is, if they're not updated, then increasingly, I think you use the word irrelevant, the WTO becomes increasingly irrelevant and, you know, will no longer be a place where countries go to Geneva to solve disputes. They'd solve disputes between them. And frankly, big countries win when there are disputes just by their market power for the most part.
So is that not what's already happening with respect to China and other countries around the world?
Well, increasingly, we are seeing that countries are taking matters into their own hands. And frankly, the United States, in many ways, has led that charge under the Trump administration. It's ignored, for example, the rules on raising tariffs against China, but in other areas, and it has just gone ahead and done so. And that has created costs in the world. And we've seen other countries, frankly, you know, they don't just take these tariffs. What do? They respond with their own tariffs. That's what China did. That's what Europe did. And, you know, that's what other trading partners are doing as well. So it's not cost-free. It's not like we can just do what we want. If that's the route we choose in trade policy, kind of a Wild West policy, then other countries are going to imitate and mirror what we're doing as well to protect their own national interests.
So coming back to your idea of, like, we've tried these three different approaches to China and none of them have really worked in terms of, you know, market access or state subsidies, is there a theory of change or should the U.S. just kind of accept this and go down the road that it seems like some senators are excited about, which is doing our own sort of, you know, version of industrial policy with the CHIPS Act and what have you?
There's not one policy that works. I think in order to deal with the China challenge, we need to be pursuing a whole slew of policies simultaneously and put weights on kind of different parts of that approach. So in any approach going forward, I think we need to be putting more weight on the approach of working with allies and partners. And frankly, you know, given China's recent trade actions against Australia for non-trade concerns, you know, I think that's showing other countries they may be next in line. So I think in many ways, that's going to increase the willingness of other countries to work with the United States in a Biden administration. But I also think there are going to be areas where we're going to need to pursue either bilateral negotiations, take unilateral actions, block Chinese investment, impose export controls, hopefully coordinated with allies and partners. And also, you know, with respect to really essential and strategic industries, to consider, I'm not going to call it industrial policy, but to consider domestic measures to support these industries in a more meaningful and robust way.
So coming back again to the role of the WTO, you write that the Trump administration identified that the current system posed by non-market economies, particularly China, fell short of delivering meaningful results. The Biden administration has underscored the importance of working with partners and with international institutions to address these problems. As a first step, the incoming administration should finalize the trilateral work with the EU and Japan on industrial subsidies, recruit wider international support, and submit a proposal to the UN for negotiation. I just have a hard time conceptualizing, Wendy, like, what China could accept on these issues in the WTO context, which would move the ball forward. Like, how does more pressure at the WTO level get at this state subsidy issue?
Well, I think the hope is that there's a growing group of WTO members that want to update these rules And China's listening to all these other countries explain why these rules need to be updated, that it will feel the pressure to engage in a negotiation. I'm not naive. I don't think this is going to be easy, but I think it's an approach and a measure and a step we should try, because to date, we haven't put anything concrete on the table. So what China can say is, oh, this is an interesting discussion, you know, see you around. But if we actually put a proposal on a table, on the table, and WTO members start discussing it, I think China's under pressure. It can choose, of course, as any WTO member can, not to participate. But then I think countries, other countries will get, including the US, will get increasingly frustrated and try and kind of figure out, well, what then, what's the next step? We're trying the rulemaking approach with China. If they don't want to participate in that and these rules don't address their practices, then maybe it's not just the US taking unilateral measures, but it's a whole group of countries coordinating measures they can take against China, again, trying to put more pressure on them to partake in negotiations on issues like industrial subsidies.
Great. So, Wendy, let's fast forward to 2022. Your former colleagues write out a wonderful proposal and China sort of shakes his head. Do we see a new body? How do you see that pressure most effectively playing out in a multilateral context?
Look, there are various ways it could play out. It could just be an ad hoc coalition of countries working together. It could be a group of countries, let's just say, working in the context of another international organization like the OECD. It could be a TPP-like approach where you work with other countries in a binding trade agreement to write rules and bring, you know, other countries on board. And basically, at some point, China is isolated. Again, you know, we'll have to see how something like this would play out. But I think the status quo is unacceptable. And what's so disappointing for me with the phase one trade agreement, that if you read what the administration was trying to achieve in these negotiations, and you think of all the firepower they put into this negotiation, at the end of the day, they didn't have the staying power to really address the tough issues that needed to be addressed. They chose to pocket what they'd achieved already. They talked about a phase two deal, and, you know, 10 months later, they never launched that negotiation. The Chinese kind of tired them out. There was negotiating fatigue. I've experienced it, but I also know that if you put everything off until the next day, you know, that day may never come.
Yeah, I mean, this is really where my pessimism about all of this comes from, because China had never seen as much pressure as it did pre-phase one deal. And if even those sort of enormous U.S. tariffs, which clearly had some impact on the broader macroeconomic situation, weren't enough to get the Chinese government willing to put more on the table. And, you know, they're still living with a lot of tariffs right now, right? So it's not like they've completely gotten out of the woods on this one. But if that didn't get any movement on this state subsidy stuff and the market access stuff, it leaves me very pessimistic that any sort of like softer, like, hey, let's, you know, we'll welcome you back into the tent as long as you sign some new rules type approach is going to have much success.
Yeah, but again, it was unilateral. And so I think we need to give another shot at kind of a multilateral approach. And again, if our other trading partners are also kind of feeling the same thing, and if it wasn't just the US restricting access to its market, but other countries as well, you know, I think we should give that approach a shot.
Great. So let's take that idea and put it into the context of what we've seen in Australia and China over the past few weeks. I'm not going to do the recap, but suffice to say that because of Australia's foreign policy moves around COVID-19, Xinjiang, and Hong Kong, China has come down like a ton of bricks on a number of key Australian exports like barley and wine, which is likely to cause serious pain to Australian producers. So I have three harebrained screams for you. The first comes from Matt Klein, economics writer at Forbes.
If Chinese consumers won't buy Australian wine, the U.S. federal government would. There are several ways to do this. The most straightforward approach would be for Congress to appropriate money to buy Australian and other allied products, financed by issuing bonds. Alternatively, if budget scoring were a concern, the government could create a special purpose vehicle to buy and hold Australian wine and other commodities in storage, financed by borrowing from the Federal Reserve. A strategic Shiraz reserve, the U.S. government could hold onto its stockpile of non-perishable goods until the Chinese government relented, at which point the U.S. could gradually sell whatever it had accumulated onto world markets, either at a profit or at a small loss. Regardless of the specifics, the U.S. has effectively limitless resources to protect its allies and its own industries from Chinese economic coercion. It's time to use that power to protect our fellow democracies.
I think that might be going too far and be too ambitious. I think as a first step, the United States and other countries in Geneva at upcoming meetings, there's a meeting of the General Council next week, countries should put China on the spot. At the senior levels, China's talking about how they are the proponents of free trade. They are anti-unilateralism. They believe in the rules-based system. Well, these measures that they've taken against Australia, in my view, clearly violate the letter and the spirit of the WTO. And I think it's really important for countries as a first step to show solidarity at the WTO by calling China out on this.
So,
and that can be complemented, for example, if Australia decides to sue China in the World Trade Organization for these restrictions. I think the U.S. and other countries should join that dispute. I think those are kind of realistic, tangible steps. And I think, frankly, they'd be really embarrassing for China on the world stage when, you know, its leader is talking about how it is the proponent of free trade. And frankly, I wonder if there aren't certain people in China's trade ministry that would welcome such calling out and even disputes because, you know, it's really hard to defend these practices and they are so inconsistent with what's being said at senior levels.
I know, but Wendy, it feels like the fact of the matter is, you know, we were talking about this at the beginning of the show, right? The trade negotiators don't have the power. And I think Xi Jinping is very happy looking, doesn't really have much of a problem looking hypocritical to the broader global community, right? So,
well, I don't know if I agree with that, but yeah, okay. I don't know if I agree with that second point. I think if the United States and other countries really were publicly expressing concerns with these policies, I think they're very hard to defend.
But I guess if I'm sitting in Australia right now, it feels like the U.S., if all they're going to do is sort of send some statements, it feels like we're sort of leaving them out in
okay,
the cold.
Well,
no,
again, or? I said as a step.
Okay.
Okay. And then I think joining them in dispute settlement is more than just making statements. But I also think we need to, you know, again, work with Australia and other countries and figure out additional steps to take. I'm not sure if like agreeing to buy the stuff that China's not buying, you know, is the right solution. And it may, frankly, propose domestic challenges for us in terms of U.S. industry saying, well, why are you using our taxpayers' dollars to buy, you know, to buy products from other countries? Why don't you buy our products? But I think there are further steps that if countries got together, they could consider taking. And I think it's really important for the international community to put their foot down on this and to know and to kind of put China on notice. It's not business as usual if this is the way you're going to be.
Yeah, I mean, it does get hard because like who gains from these tariffs on Australia? You know, American wine producers, right? Who gain market share? So having like the national security argument trump the gain that domestic economic interests would have for this sort of thing, I think is, you know, tricky to pull off for sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure if our wine exports are going to be increasing there. But even domestically, the notion that our government would be like buying up products from another country that's facing restrictions from China. I mean, I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, but I think we'd really need to think through that and think through the domestic fallout from something like that.
Sure.
There are probably other steps that can be taken with more teeth that, you know, could be brainstormed. For example, if the United States just convened with Australia a meeting of other middle-sized countries in Asia, Europe, and elsewhere to discuss this issue and come up with concrete list of steps they could take.
But I mean, we're here on the show. This is our time for the concrete steps, right? So let me throw another one at you. We have the idea of a mutual trade defense pact, sort of like modeled on Article 5, collective self-defense, where you have some sort of automatic snapback
when China does something like this, which doesn't necessarily have to wait, you know, 2-3 years for the WTO process to play itself out. What am I missing when I dream this up last night?
Well, I think what the US and other like-minded countries could, you know, should do is look at steps they can take against China together.
Yeah.
Which, you know, China exports a lot to the world, okay? And you look at their November export statistics, they were off the charts. And so if countries could coordinate and say, if China does, you know, X, Y, and Z, we are going to coordinate our policies, work together to kind of take reciprocal actions against Chinese imports.
Sure. So this one, you're a little more, you're not willing to throw out quite as quickly.
Well, again, I'm not throwing out any of them. I haven't given like a whole, I would need to give thought to all of these in more detail. But this notion of an article like a NATO against China on trade is, I mean, maybe that goes a little too far. But the idea of coordinating responses for unacceptable behavior, you know, my mind should be at the top of the list for any type of international discussions on this topic, because it's not going to stop with Australia. It didn't start with Australia. We've seen it with Korea. We've seen it with Japan on rare earths. We've seen it with Philippines on bananas. But the Australia moves are just, they seem to be escalating. No end seems to be in sight. And frankly, you know, I don't think it's going to end with Australia if there is not an international response, because what does China conclude then? Basically, they have the market power to do this, and it's cost-free. So the message to other countries is, you know, don't criticize us because we'll hit your products next.
And I think on that, we're in complete agreement. Thinking about the toolkit that the executive branch has to address these sorts of issues, do you think Section 232 and 301 are enough, or should Congress consider adding something to USTR's bag of tricks if this is the sort of game that we end up playing, you know, for the foreseeable future?
I'm a proponent of a really detailed review of our existing group of trade laws and to test whether they are adequate. Like, one area where I think they are inadequate is the whole area of overcapacity. And that is where China is pouring huge amounts of money into subsidizing and providing financial assistance to certain industries. And it's just a matter of time before the products of the companies that receive these subsidies are going to be exporting them in huge volumes and creating huge international trade distortions. And the way our trade laws are written, by the time you can respond, you know, to these types of practices, it's often too late. So this is a concrete example of kind of a practice where I think our trade laws should be updated to allow responses at an earlier time and to have kind of a less burden on the petitioner, for example, to have to show concrete harm or concrete injury. In other words, if you look at industries like the solar industry and frankly now the semiconductor industry, it's quite apparent that there's no way China's building up these industries just for its own domestic consumption. It wants to kind of lead in these sectors and sell these products overseas over time. And so I think we need to be able to act quicker, smarter, and earlier. But I think overall, we need to look at our trade laws and to see if they work, if they're agile enough, if they really get at the right problems, and if we need to have any either adjustments or additions. I think that would be, you know, a good step for the next administration to take.
So to what extent does adding to this toolkit and speeding up the kind of like retaliation that the U.S. can do undermine the WTO system? Or are you sort of not worried about that because this cat is out of the bag?
Well, my concern is if we wait for the WTO to update the rules, then we may be waiting forever. Yeah. If we were on the verge of updating our rules and we go to Geneva and we say, this is what we plan to do, we want to work with you to see if we can also do this in the context of an international negotiation, I think that, you know, that gives a better shot for success in Geneva. But, you know, frankly, someone who's been a proponent of WTO rules for almost my whole career, I'm at the point as well where if the WTO can't update their rules and strengthen them, then I think the U.S. and other countries may be left with no choice but to pursue, you know, certain measures.
Any other final reflections?
I would just say I couldn't agree with you more where a lot of your questions are headed, that China brings a lot of challenges to the international trading system, and it's unclear how we're going to deal with them, particularly as China becomes more and more immune to international pressure. And frankly, as its market power, you know, continues to grow. But all that said, we can't give up. And the answer shouldn't be, you know, we should all just be taking reciprocal actions. I think we need to keep trying to improve the rules. But in order to do that, I don't think we can do that alone. I think the past 4 years has shown that. So let's give a shot to working with our allies and partners more closely, working within the WTO, but again, being ready to take unilateral measures or ready to negotiate certain things bilaterally if needed as well. Let's just shift the weight in the types of approaches we're taking towards China.
Wendy Cutler, thanks so much for being a part of China Talk.
Well, thank you.
For more on everything China, including an interview with incoming NSA Jake Sullivan on U.S.-China relations, please subscribe to my podcast by searching China Talk in your favorite podcast app and subscribe to my newsletter at chinatalk.substack.com. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Go to the Lawfare store at thelawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, socks, and t-shirts. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. Our music performed, as always, by Sophia Yan. Thank you for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.